Welcome to the first of the afternoon's entertainment. Okay, we've got a talk on the Social Revolution and the Spanish Civil War. The county of Lancashire has been responsible for some remarkable individuals. I'm thinking of George Formby and Gracie Fields. And
Tommy Handley. Tommy Handley.
I'm not quite that old, sorry. But to join Gracie and George, though, there's also Steve Clayton here. Comrade Clayton, one of Lancashire's finest exiles. And Steve's going to be talking on the Spanish Civil War.
Okay, yeah, good afternoon, everybody. Is that loud enough? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not really going to talk about the war, actually. I'm not going to talk about the Spanish Civil War. I'm going to talk about social revolution while this war was going on. That's going to bring me with a quote from the Social Standard in July 2006, which was on the 70th anniversary of the Spanish Civil War. And one of our writers wrote, "The Spanish Civil War has an immense ability for people to read their own interests and perspectives into it." And these are my own interests and perspectives. That's what I'm going to talk about today. So in an introduction, just talk briefly about Spain. I mean, three or four centuries before, it was the first world power. But by 1936, Spain was moribund. Features that had virtually died out in the rest of Europe were still very much alive. There was a military class, a priestly class, competing monarchical claims, and there was near serfdom among seasonal rural labourers and mass illiteracy amongst the peasantry. I mean, Hugh Thomas said there had not been in Spain a middle-class revolution on the model of that in France in 1789. In the period of like the 1920s, 30s, the working class parties were in a perpetual state of revolutionary effervescence. It was a period of intense class struggle in Spain. The Asturian Miners' Revolt of 1934 has been described as the first battle of the Spanish Civil War. So come to 1936, and there's a general election in February of 1936, and a bourgeois democratic government of liberal Catholic Republicans is elected on a popular front manifesto. It's effectively backed by the majority of the Spanish working class, and they're pledged to introduce certain reforms, limited concessions to be granted to the working class. Even the anarcho-syndicalists, the anarchists, actually voted for the first time in an election at this time. I mean, we wrote at the time in the Social Standard, the aim of the Republican government was to change the constitution and governmental system in the direction of capitalist development. You know, bourgeois liberals had gained control of the machinery of government. There was a need in Spain for rapid industrialisation to keep pace in the global capitalist system. I mean, Orwell described the military rising by Franco as a military mutiny backed up by the aristocracy and the church, and that it was an attempt to restore feudalism. That's not strictly the case. Franco and the nationalists, the landowners, the army and the church and elements of the bourgeoisie actually wanted. They wanted a slower development of capitalism with a consequent loss of liberal democracy. I mean, the landowners were particularly opposed to Republican agrarian reforms, which meant splitting up of the estates amongst the land workers. So I've got some images to show, so I'm moving them along. And also the nationalists, if they got into power, would deprive the workers of the power to organise in political parties and industrially in trade unions. And this would deprive, deprive the working class of the franchise, the abolition of liberal democracy. And therefore the vital democratic interests of the working class would be at stake. I'm just going to talk about the war now for a few seconds. I mean, it's called the Spanish Civil War, but that's actually a misnomer, because just after a few months, it actually became a European war by proxy, and a dress rehearsal for the Second World War. I mean, Franco received material support from Mussolini's Italy and Hitler's Germany. Only the Soviet Union and Mexico were the countries who actually pledged any support for the Republic. Mexico, because of the distance, could only provide limited support. Also, during the war of 1936-39, both sides developed large regular armies. Well, in the case of Franco, they already had the army. And they launched First World War-type offensives. Well, we heard about that in the previous talk. So the war basically became a war of attrition, trench warfare, and it ultimately ended in the Republic's defeat. Now, however, in Catalonia, Aragon, and other parts of Republican Spain, during the time of the war, a social revolution took place. Revolutionary militias actually fought Franco's forces, but they also fought this war to protect and expand the revolution, which I will be talking about in this talk. And the central government in Madrid lost control of these areas for up to 2 years. The CNT, it was the largest workers' organisation in Spain, comprising 2 million members. It's the National Confederation of Labour. It was established in 1911. The sort of the ideological heart of the CNT trade union was the Iberian Anarchist Federation, which had been established in 1927. They comprised about 50,000 members, and it was the CNT and the FAI that crushed the military rebellion in Barcelona. They were very strong in Aragon, Barcelona, Valencia and Alicante. They believed in government by local committees and resistance to all forms of centralised authoritarianism. This is a memorial to the CNT unveiled in 2011 in Barcelona to commemorate 100 years of the trade union. The anarcho-syndicalist flag. The anarchists in the FAI and the CNT, basically uncompromising hostility to the bourgeoisie and to the church. So we'll talk briefly about the Roman Catholic Church in Spain. I mean, I've got a quote here from an anarchist who said, "Priests are subhuman. They begin by not marrying, which is not decent." And in Barcelona itself, all 58 churches were burned. Only the cathedral was spared. Church schools were closed down. As I said, churches were burned, convents were burned, sacked, the breaking of images and sacred objects. There was a lot of killing, I mean, killing on both sides. I've got figures here saying 13 bishops were killed, 7,000 clergy were killed, including priests, nuns, monks, militant Christians, members of apostolic and pious organisations. Basically, this is the anarchists and the working class actually settling accounts against the clergy and the desire for revenge on religion, which had basically kept them in slavish degradation. Gerald Brennan wrote that the Catholic Church, the anarchist, was the fountain of all evil, the corrupter of youth, with its vile doctrine of original sin, the blasphemer against nature and the law of nature, which they call salut, or health. It is also the religion which mocks with its pretense of brotherly love and mutual forgiveness the great ideal of human solidarity. Great picture here. This is, I suppose, anarchist CNT militias. That's a propaganda piece. They're shooting rifles at a statue of Christ the Redeemer or something like that. I mean, the church controlled the schools and it taught the working class to actually recite the scriptures but never to read and write. So let me just talk about anarcho-syndicalism or revolutionary syndicalism. The best sort of definition is from France in 1906, a charter of the CGT trade union. I mean, in that charter it says anarcho-syndicalists stand for the abolition of the wages system, the expropriation of the capitalist class, and the means to this end would be the general strike. And also, quite importantly, which is as it is reflected in Spain in this talk I'll talk about, the trade union will be in the future the unit of production and distribution and the basis of social organisation. And the theory of the general strike had been developed by the French syndicalists, and it was very, very popular in Spain. It was believed by the CNT and the FAI that it was the one effective weapon the working class had, and a sure means to the socialist or anarchist goal. So the CNT workers believed in like an ongoing economic struggle with one crowning battle, one quick insurrection based on a general strike, and then they would overthrow capitalism. So basically the CNT and the FAI had been training for the kind of situation which a general strike and a short, sharp period of insurrection would topple the state and bring in free communism. I mean, the revolution in the countryside, which we'll come to talk about, was a natural outcome of decades of anarchist propaganda. As I spoke about illiteracy amongst the peasantry, what would happen was pamphlets would be circulated and read by the one say, labourer who would be able to read. I've got a nice quote from José Peraz. He wrote, "The gathering together of a group of labourers in their quarters to listen to a reading of anarchist literature under the flickering light of an oil lamp was a common scene in the Andalusian countryside." One of the most widely circulated pamphlets was called Among the Peasants, or Between the Peasants, A Dialogue on Anarchy by Errico Malatesta. And in this little pamphlet here, he would make effective use of dialogue. It'd be a chat between two peasants, one more politicised than the other. And it was an educative and an instrument of propaganda to distribute amongst the peasants. And the CNT FII distributed hundreds and hundreds of pamphlets in the 1920s and into the 30s, and it formed the basis for a report that they called the concept of libertarian communism, which was presented at their National Congress on the 1st of May 1936 in Zaragoza. I'll just give you some selected pamphlet titles. The Bankruptcy of the Political and Economic System of Capitalism, Libertarian Communism, the Possibilities of its Realisation in Spain, The Society of the Future, Toward Libertarian Communism, and the best one of all, The Love of Libertarian Communism. So at this Congress, the anarchists basically formulated their demands for collectivisation. And again, just to bring in Bakunin, who is a great influence on Spanish anarchism. I mean, he always liked to picture the coming revolution as a spontaneous uprising of an infuriated town mob or a peasant jacquerie, you know, a French peasant revolt of the Middle Ages. But in fact, in Spain, the anarcho-syndicalists have been planning for decades, like as you can see with this sort of propaganda and lots of their congresses. So the anarchists believe that every factory, area of land should be owned collectively by the workers, and that these collectives should be linked with each other on a federal basis, that is, without any superior central authority. In Barcelona, the CNT owned its own radio station. It had 8 daily newspapers, weeklies and periodicals. There were frequent public meetings. And just in Barcelona alone, the CNT had about 350,000 members. Something that I didn't actually know about while doing this research, I came across this. Back in 1931, when the International Olympic Committee were allocating the Olympic Games for 1936, it was a tie between Berlin and Barcelona. And this is obviously before the Nazi takeover of power in 1933. And the committee voted to give the Olympics to Berlin. Obviously, by 1936, Berlin was part of the Nazi Germany. And when the Popular Front government was elected in February 1936, it decided to boycott the Berlin Olympics because of the Nazi regime and set up an alternate games, which it was described as the People's Olympiad, Olimpiada Popular. And it was to be held in Barcelona on the 19th of July to the 26th of July 1936. And it would end just a few days before the Berlin Olympics were scheduled to start. A total of 6,000 athletes from 22 nations actually registered to come. Now, those dates might not mean a lot to you, but basically what happened was on the 18th of July, one day before this, Franco and the military, the uprising took place. And on the 19th of July, the day that the Games were supposed to start in Barcelona, there was a widespread general strike in Barcelona, and basically the working class took over Barcelona. So the Olympics never took place. There was a bullfight scheduled, obviously, for that Sunday afternoon. Bullfights being very popular in Spain, and you always used to take place on a Sunday. So Sunday the 19th of July is what I'm talking about now, and was the date when the army left the barracks in Barcelona. I'll just talk about Barcelona in particular. The army left the barracks in the morning, and there was obviously this threat was always coming up, because a couple of days before, Franco had revolted in another part of Spain. I mean, the CNT made a statement straight away, back the Revolutionary General Strike, the very instant anyone means the military, revolts, we the people of Catalonia, let us be on a war footing and ready to act. Be valiant, arm yourselves, and do battle. Long live the CNT, long live libertarian communism, launch the Revolutionary General Strike against fascism. In Barcelona, factory and ship sirens actually began to wail as troops were leaving the barracks, and it was the call to the CNT and the FAI to come onto the streets. And they basically unearthed weapons that had been hiding for a couple of years, and for 36 hours the workers, these trade unionists, anarchist workers, fought the military in Barcelona and defeated them. This crisis of the military uprising, the working class actually saved the Spanish Republic. It saved Barcelona, Valencia, Catalonia, Aragon, Madrid and Asturias and other parts from the army. I think about two-thirds of Spain was within control of the Republican side, and one-third the nationalists under Franco. So the workers and the peasants stalled the military coup, and it led to a three-year war. So immediately in Barcelona, effectively the workers have actually taken over, and the government has ceased to function with any power. And revolutionary organisations are set up straight away. And basically, they are committees. I mean, the first one is the Supply Committee, which was born in the barrios, the working class districts in Barcelona. and it organised communal dining with dining halls with food confiscated from shops, and it gathered contents of the small stores into large warehouses for redistribution. So it was a very exciting time in Barcelona in 1936 and Spain in the Republican areas. Stephen Spender, the poet, said, "Spain offered the 20th century and 1848. Hugh Thomas wrote, English public opinion was as inflamed by the Spanish War as it once had been by the French Revolution." I think Bakunin, though, his comments about Paris in 1848 could be transferred to Barcelona in 1936. He wrote about Paris in 1848 as, "I breathed through all my senses and through all my pores the intoxication of the revolutionary atmosphere. It was a holiday without beginning and without end. I saw everyone and I saw no one, for each individual was lost in the same innumerable and wandering crowd. I spoke to all I met without remembering either my own words or those of others, for my attention was absorbed at every step by new events and objects and by unexpected news." Well, there's a picture of the fairy freak brother. So the government of Catalonia, Barcelona, was actually the anti-fascist militias committee, which had been established on the 23rd of July, so 4 days after the revolution. Well, I should say, actually, there is a general strike going on in Barcelona at this moment as we speak. There's no work actually going on. The factories have closed because of the general strike. But this anti-fascist militias committee comprised sort of 12 representatives from the CNT, from the UGT, which was a socialist trade union, one from the PUM, who were anti-Stalinist, semi-Trotskyite group, the PSUC, which was the Catalonian Communist Party, and five Republicans. This committee organised industrial production and food supplies, and it coordinated the campaign to liberate Zaragoza. So effectively, the capitalist class actually lost control through the breakdown of the government machine. At this time, the Catalan government had literally become a decorative body, and the government in Madrid had no control of what was happening in Catalonia. So this general strike lasted from the 19th of July to the 28th of July. It ended on the 28th of July following a communique from the local Federation of Barcelona Unions, and it said, "End the general strike and return to work." That links in with something what Kropotkin wrote. He said that the great revolutionary task would not be for the workers to stop working, but to continue working on their own account. But while this general strike had been going on, they said the factories had actually been taken over. So the railways, the stations, public transport, waterworks, electric plants, metalworks had all been taken over in this period. A CNT statement of this time states, "The economic system of the bourgeoisie has totally broken down, and democracy, which has failed politically and socially, has no solutions to offer. The workers' organisations, particularly the CNT and the anarchist movement, should lend themselves to the task of a complete economic reconstruction, from collectivisation of the workplace to socialisation of land, mines and industries." The poet and communist John Cornford graduated from Cambridge in July 1936 and went straight away to Spain. He wrote to his girlfriend Margot Heinemann in August that year, and he was describing the situation as he saw it in Catalonia. He wrote, "In Catalonia, things are like this. There is the left Republican government, but in fact the real power is with the workers. There are 50,000 or more armed workers. The anarchists predominate. 75% of industry in Barcelona is already socialised and mostly worked by the anarchists. Assisted by the militia, there is a peasant war raging in the countryside. The anarchists appear to be preparing to attack Zaragoza." I mean, Cornford was actually a member of the British Communist Party, but he ended up in the anti-Stalinist PUM militia, as did George Orwell, on the Aragon Front. But he did later transfer to the British Battalion of the International Brigade, where he was killed in action in December 1936. Just a quick word about workers' control. I mean, it has its origin in anarcho-syndicalism. I think I spoke about it briefly earlier. The basic unit would be the industrial union, and that would be the basis of the new society. So workers in a particular industry would own and control that industry through their union, and own and control the means of production. So workers on the shop floor would control production through a workshop organisation. But it has to be stated that this is control of the productive system by units less than society. Just a few examples of like some of the collectivization in Barcelona. The Ford Iberian company, I mean, once that was collectivized, at first the managing director stayed on as a technician and then he fled. There were 338 workers there, and the factory was run by an elected committee of about 18 workers. These factory committees would obviously organise shifts, production, labour, and wages. Wages were still being paid, but wages were more uniform with less differentials. I mean, bosses basically had either fled or had been shot. And those that actually remained were those who had a good reputation for labour relations. So in Barcelona, long list some pictures of sort of like collectivised industry. That's men using sewing machines in Barcelona in 1936, which is an unusual picture. So we've got railways, telecommunications, utilities, streetcars, buses, taxi cabs, shipping, electric light, everything, mills, food processing, theatres, cinemas, everything was collectivised. I think Orwell points out even the bootblacks were collectivised and with shining shoes on boxes painted red and black. Now, this complete workers' control in Barcelona lasted from July to October 1936, when the Generalitat, which is the government of Catalonia, passed a decree basically trying to coordinate the collectivisation. This was in October, and they said firms of 100-plus workers can be collectivised, but anything under 100 people should be a vote of the workforce. And they wanted all collectivised enterprises to join a general industrial council, a central planning agency, in effect. They also passed, obviously, a decree on collectivisation of in agriculture, which I haven't spoken about yet, but I will do. But, I mean, the CNT statement in response to imposing sort of narrow legal conditions on land seizures, for example, they said, the peasants do not need decrees to solve their vital problems. Indeed, they anticipate them by expropriating both the lands of owners who participate in the military conspiracy and those of owners who did not. Franz Borkenau arrived in Barcelona less than 3 weeks after the 19th of July revolution. And I mean, he's not wholly sympathetic to anarchism, but he couldn't be help but be impressed by what they'd actually achieved. I mean, he visited a collectivised workshop of the General Bus Company, and he wrote, "Factory is a big success for the CNT, run as smoothly as if nothing had happened. Since socialisation, this factory has repaired two buses, finished one which has been under construction, and constructed a completely new one. The latter wore the inscription, 'Constructed under workers' control.' It is an extraordinary achievement for a group of workers to take over one factory and within a few days to make it run with complete regularity. It bears brilliant witness to the general standard of efficiency of the Catalan worker and to the organising capacities of the Barcelona trade unions." I mean, most of the industrial collectives, though, were operated with the war effort in mind. Gaston Laval, he describes the industrial collectives in Barcelona, Catalonia, as another form of capitalism, but managed by the workers themselves. I mean, he wrote, "Workers in each undertaking took over the factory, the works, or the workshop, the machines, raw materials, and taking advantage of the continuation of the money system and normal capitalist commercial relations, organised production on their own account, selling for their own benefit the produce of their labour." To speak briefly about the militias, which were the groups of armed workers that initially stopped Franco and the military from taking over. I mean, if the government, the Republican government, had waited to train troops at its disposal, Franco would never have been resisted, and it would have been triumphant all throughout Spain. I mean, in the militias, there was no hierarchy, there was no saluting, no titles, there was no heel clicking, no uniforms or distinctions in pay and quartering. Officers were actually democratically elected, and they did not have permanent authority. Women actually served at the front in the militias. Orwell has quite a good few pages on the militias in his Homage to Catalonia. He writes, "It was understood that orders had to be obeyed, but it was also understood that when you gave an order, you gave it as a comrade to a comrade, and not as a superior to an inferior. In practice, the democratic revolutionary type of discipline is more reliable than might be expected. In a workers' army, discipline is theoretically voluntary, is based on class loyalty, whereas the discipline of a bourgeois conscript army is based ultimately on fear. So he wrote, when a man refuses to obey an order, you appeal to him in the name of comradeship. This is a CNT FAI or FAI poster, which actually says the revolution and the war are inseparable, because that is what they believed. They wrote, the thousands of proletarian combatants at the battlefronts are not fighting for the Democratic Republic. They are proletarian revolutionaries who have taken up arms in order to make the revolution. To postpone the triumph of the latter until after we win the war would weaken considerably the fighting spirit of the working class. The revolution and the war are inseparable. Everything that is said to the contrary is reformist counter-revolution. I mean, the most famous anarchist militia is the Durruti Column. In July 1936, the Catalan Anti-Fascist Militias Committee delegated Durruti to organise an anti-fascist militia, the Durruti Column, and it set out on the 23rd of July to liberate Zaragoza on the Aragon front. In August 1936, just before the assault on the city, Durruti was interviewed by a Pravda journalist called Mikhail Koltsov. Just a quick aside about Koltsov, he was actually Stalin's man on the ground in Spain. It's rumoured that he had a phone line direct to Stalin in the Kremlin. And he was actually recalled to Russia in 1938 and liquidated in the purges. I can only say that he probably saw too much in Spain and had to be exterminated. Durruti said to Koltsov, it is possible that only 100 of us will survive, but with that 100, we shall enter Zaragoza, beat fascism and proclaim libertarian communism. I will be the first to enter. We shall proclaim the free commune. We shall subordinate ourselves neither to Madrid nor Barcelona. We shall show you Bolsheviks how to make a revolution. I mean, Durruti is a man of action rather than a theorist, but I've just got a few other things that he said, and I want to say them because they're quite poetical. Things like, this reminds me of Bakunin, actually, and the thing about the eternal spirit which destroys and annihilates. You know, the urge to destroy is also a creative urge. I think I can read Bakunin in Durruti here. He says, we have always lived in slums and holes in the wall. We will know how to accommodate ourselves for a time. For you must not forget, we can also build. It is we, the workers, who built these palaces and cities here in Spain and America and everywhere. We, the workers, can build others to take their place and better ones. We are not in the least afraid of ruins. We are going to inherit the earth. There's not the slightest doubt about that. The bourgeoisie might blast and ruin its own world before it leaves the stage of history. We carry a new world here in our hearts. That world is growing this minute. We are anarcho-syndicalists. We fight for the revolution. We make revolution here in Spain right now, not after the next European war. We, the workers, can build new palaces and cities to replace those destroyed. This is from an anonymous comrade in the Durruti Column, which I got from Peter Newell. This comrade in the Durruti Column wrote, the column is neither militarily or bureaucratically organised. It has grown organically. It is a social revolutionary movement. We represent a union of oppressed proletarians fighting for freedom for all. The column is the work of Durruti, who determined its spirit and defended its libertarian principles until his last breath. The foundation of the column is voluntary self-discipline, and the end of its activity is nothing less than libertarian communism. So the Durruti column was like advancing through Aragon, and when any area was liberated from the nationalists and Franco's forces, collectivisation of agriculture took place. I mean, Aragon became known as the Spanish Ukraine. And now, I'm trying to work out why it's called the Spanish Ukraine. I think there's two ways of looking at this. In one sense of the word, it's like a breadbasket because of the verdant valleys, the rich pasture lands and livestock breeding that was in Aragon. But also, in effect, though, it was you could go back to the 1917 and 1919 Russian Revolution, and it was the Spanish Ukraine, i.e. it was an anarchist stronghold in opposition to the centralised Bolshevik government in Moscow, and in the Spanish situation against the centralised Madrid government. So basically an anarchist stronghold as well as the agricultural breadbasket of that part of Spain. So what was it actually like living in the revolutionary Spain, you know, that part of the Republican Spain? I mean, immediately following the defeat of the military, there was a feeling of fiesta. I mean, I think straight away of Wordsworth's lines about the French Revolution, bliss was it in that dawn to be alive. John Cornford wrote, the place is free, this is on Barcelona, the place is free and conscious all the time of its freedom. I mean, a CNT FII bulletin from the Metro Workers Committee said, now we set out on a great adventure. So this is no like staged Stalinist Bolshevik type revolution. This is like Paris Commune again, I feel. And then the Situationists wrote in 1962 about the Paris Commune. The Commune was the biggest festival of the 19th century. Underlying the events of that spring of 1871, one could see the insurgents feeling that they had become masters of their own history. I get the sense Paris Commune, Barcelona 1936, very similar. Another nice little touch, André Malraux, the writer, he wrote about the noise in Barcelona. He said, caused by the return of many sewing machines previously in pawn shops. So all of a sudden, there was a lot of women would have been like sewing at home. And the noise, I can't imagine what it would sound like, but, you know, obviously they were all in the pawn shops, and as soon as the revolution took place, everything was taken out. Other things like, I mean, Orwell, he arrives in Barcelona in December 1936, so it's about 6 months after the revolution, and it's still roughly the same as it was probably in the summer of 36. I mean, he wrote things like, every shop and cafe had an inscription that had been collectivised. I mentioned the bootblacks had been collectivised. Waiters and shop walkers looked you in the face and treated you as an equal. Servile and even ceremonial forms of speech had been temporarily got rid of. Nobody said señor or don. Everybody called everybody comrade and said salud instead of buenos dias. Tipping was forbidden by law. There were no private motor cars. He says the wealthy classes had practically ceased to exist. And he ends on this line, which I sums it up really. There was a belief in the revolution and the future, a feeling of having suddenly emerged into an era of equality and freedom. Human beings were trying to behave as human beings and not as cogs in the capitalist machine. One nice little anecdote I came across was one man called Fernandez de Dios, so Dios, Spanish for God, I think, he wrote to the Minister of Justice in Madrid, and he said, can I change my surname to Bakunin? Because he didn't want anything to do with God. In Barcelona and Madrid, no one wore hats, ties, collars. I mean, to wear a tie in Barcelona was to risk arrest. Bullfighting continued, but the matadors, instead of wearing the three-cornered hats, they were wearing berets and would address the crowds with their clenched fists. A bit about food. In a collectivised restaurant organised by the trade unions in Madrid, a lavish dish of rice and potatoes boiled with meat was served in unlimited quantities. So all the taboos about conservatism and religiosity in Spain were being challenged. Divorce was made easier. Abortion was actually made on demand in Catalonia. And marriage, weddings, a new concept arrived called revolutionary weddings. These were like free unions with no marriage ceremonies. Because obviously women were marrying men, because men were actually going off to the fight at the front, and they needed to produce some sort of documentary evidence. So the trade union, being like this basis of the new society, the trade union official acted as a registrar and would marry the man and the woman, and three copies of the certificate would be produced, one for the trade union and two for the couple. And when the dissolution, when the marriage wanted to be dissolved, the couple would present themselves back at Union HQ to dissolve the marriage. Also, life in revolutionary Spain, there was a thirst for education amongst the young and adults, bearing in mind, you know, the mass illiteracy of the sort of rural working class. The anarchist García Oliver was actually a minister in government, and an anarchist and a minister in government. We'll talk about that in the discussion later, probably. He wrote, justice cannot be restricted within the bonds of a profession. Not that we totally despise books and lawyers, but there have been too many laws and too many lawyers. When relations between men become what they should be, there would be no need to steal and kill. for the first time, let us admit here in Spain that the common criminal is not an enemy of society. He's more likely to be a victim. Who dares say that he would not steal if driven by hunger and the need to feed his family? Justice, I firmly believe, is so subtle a thing that to interpret it, one has only need of a heart. We've talked briefly about the role of women in the Spanish Revolution. An organisation was set up called Free Women. It was set up prior to the revolution in July 1936. Had its own magazine, which ran for the whole 3 years, 14 issues, and its aim was to awaken the female conscience towards libertarian ideas. They had a peak membership of 38,000 women. They held their first national congress in 1937. Their aims were to create a conscious and responsible feminine force that will act as a vanguard of progress, to establish for this purpose schools, institutes, lectures, special courses, to train the women and emancipate her from the triple slavery to which she has been and still is submitted: the slavery of ignorance, the slavery of being a woman, and the slavery of being a worker. So there's a link already between women's liberation and social revolution. Women's problems are inseparable from social problems. I mean, women's, as I spoke earlier about the militias, women served in the militias. There was actually a women's battalion that fought before the Segovia Bridge in the mountains northwest of Madrid in 1936-37. And as I said, women were in the anarchist and PUM militias. But the role of women was made easier, women felt more emancipated. An 18-year-old dressmaker called Teresa Panier, 18-year-old dressmaker, was addressing mass meetings in Barcelona in 1936-37. The revolution in the countryside, collectivisation of agriculture. I mean, Gerald Brennan writes about the agrarian question. This is the real sticking point in Spain, the agrarian question. It was a pressing one. The breaking up of the large estates. Under present conditions, there were agricultural labourers dying of hunger on estates where large tracts of corn-growing land were lying fallow because it did not pay the landowners to cultivate them. The high labour costs due to geographical conditions of Spanish wheat forbade export abroad, and as much as can be sold at the price current in Spain, though not nearly as much as could be eaten. But if the villagers could cultivate their land collectively using modern machinery, they could feed themselves and sell the surplus, writes Gerald Brennan. I mean, Bakunin, as I mentioned earlier, he's the creator of the peasant anarchism of southern Europe, especially Spain. This is the only country where his ideas actually took root in a mass movement. I mean, he wrote, "The peasants should take the land and throw out those landlords who live by the labour of others." I mean, 5 years of agrarian reform, the Republican government, this is prior to 1936, legally redistributed 876,000 hectares of land to the peasants. But in a few weeks in July 1936, the anarchist peasantry directly expropriated and collectivised 5.7 million hectares, which comprised about 7 million peasants. They declared libertarian communism. This collectivisation in the countryside did not survive more than 2.5 farm seasons. I mean, in some areas where the nationalist advance was rapid, it did not actually last far beyond the first harvest. So what actually happened in the villages? So once the landlords and the church had been kicked out of these areas, the inhabitants of a village would get together in a big meeting. And basically the concept of yours and mine would no longer exist. Everything would belong to everybody else. There would be the soil, the farm buildings, the machinery, the transport, the livestock was all collectivised. A committee was elected to supervise the running of the collective. And work was parcelled out amongst groups of 10 to 15 people and coordinated by meetings of delegates nominated by each group. So different persons, known as delegados, would look after different branches of work: cattle, wine, oil, the statistics and the administration. The delegados would meet together in a council of administration, which was established by a vote of the General Assembly of the collective. The General Assembly guided the policy of the collective. It's sort of similar to some primitive Athenian direct democracy. But the committees of delegados and the council of admin effectively ran the collective. I mean, George Woodcock, he describes what's happening here. As with Stanley, Godwin, Kropotkin, Morris, it's the same agrarian vision of men working together in the fields and then taking, according to their own estimates of their just needs, from the common barns and storehouse without any mechanism of currency or exchange. I mean, Kropotkin wrote, the basic unit of the future society should be the free commune. And these communes linked in a loose federation. This is anarchist communism. So this anarchist communism would be stateless, moneyless, and a wageless society. Production for use, and not for profit. In The Conquest of Bread, Kropotkin refuted the concept of labour time vouchers. He's saying it makes no sense trying to measure an individual's contribution to production when it's cooperative and social. If production was still individual, it would not be fair to ration a person's consumption by the number of hours worked, because skills being used would have been acquired and benefited from previous society and earlier generations. So labour time prices are obviously subject to supply and demand, inflation, devaluation, which is a definition of a monetary system. The collectives differed from region to region. Life actually changed out of all recognition in the agricultural areas. I mean, hours of work could be sunrise to sunset, but in some collectives, they agreed a 7 or 8 hour working day, which was a major advancement for rural workers. Festivals were ignored, except for new ones of the revolution, such as the 1st of May, International Workers' Day. The 20th of November was celebrated, the anniversary of the death of Durruti. And the 19th of July was always celebrated as being the start of the revolution. Obviously, these festivals were only celebrated one or two times because of the short span of time that I'm actually talking about. In one collective, Laura Del Rio, fighting bulls, which belonged to the local landowning family, were slaughtered, and many families ate steaks for the first time in their lives. Franz Borkenau and John Cornford travelled around Spain together and witnessed the burning of property records. They saw huge bonfires in the middle of main squares in small towns where documents relating to rural property were burned. Not only like was the agricultural part of a village or small town collectivised, but the shops, barbers, blacksmiths, carpenters, doctors, pharmacies would also be collectivised. And approximately, I've got the figures vary, but I've got about 2,500 rural collectives in Andalusia, Valencia, Murcia, Castile, and Aragon. I mean, the size of collectives varied from, I mean, one of the largest was called Util and had over 600 families. And it went down to, say, two farms, which was taken over by just 20 families comprising 92 persons. So there's a wide range of size of collectives. It's been quite a while. I won't give you any more quotes from Franz Borkenau. He was surprised about the effectiveness of the collectivisation of agriculture. I should just speak briefly about the Communist Party. The Communist Party in Spain was run under the diktat of Stalin in Moscow. I mean, this Bolshevik Leninist vanguard party. And well, the Bolsheviks' hatred for anarchism and libertarian socialism is well known. They'd already suppressed the revolt in Kronstadt in 1921 and suppressed Nestor Makhno's Cossack Ukrainian army in the early 1920s. But what the Communist Party did in Spain, they basically denied that there was any revolution taking place. They opposed all collectivizations and supported the petty bourgeoisie, the small proprietor, the small tenant farmer. And this is all in line with the Comintern policy, which, again, as I said, was subordinated to the defence of the Soviet Union. So they promoted bourgeois democracy and basically deliberately destroyed the egalitarian spirit of the early days of the Spanish Revolution. I mean, even John Cornford, who was a member of the Communist Party, he said, "I fear that the party, the Communist Party, is a little too mechanical in its application of people's front tactics. It is still concentrating too much on trying to neutralise the petty bourgeoisie, when by far the most urgent task is to win the anarchist workers." I mean, it is believed that Stalin wrote to the Prime Minister Caballero, and he said, "Forget about the social revolution during the war. Don't antagonise foreigners. Don't confiscate their property. Don't confiscate the property of peasant farmers. Don't allow the anarchists basically to collectivise anything. and don't demonise the middle class. So after about May 1937, so less than a year after the revolution, worker power, well, workers' control of industry was quickly pursued in Barcelona and Catalonia. And basically, there was a swing in Republican Spain towards the right. I mean, slogans like respect the property of the peasant, no interference with the small businessman, no socialisation of industry. And even Negrin, the sort of communist, well, he wasn't a communist, I think he was a puppet prime minister of the communists, he actually stated, we respect private property. The communist press actually denied any sort of revolution was actually taking place in Spain. I mean, the Daily Worker in this country, i.e. the Morning Star, denied anything like what I've been talking about actually happened. These are just some stats. I don't know if people can read them. I have printed them out. Just quickly, I'm coming to the end now. It's interesting figures. Now, Catalonia, now Barcelona was the centre of anarchism and anarcho-syndicalism. But in the countryside, interestingly enough, Catalonia was the stronghold of the peasant proprietor, the smallholder. And I think that can be, you can account for the fact that there was a decline in wheat production in 1937. But in Aragon, which was the heart of collectivization, the heart of Aragonese anarcho-syndicalism, there's a massive increase. Even in Castile, a huge increase of wheat production because these are the areas which were mostly collectivized. Catalonia itself, less collectivization. And I think the veracity of these stats can be proven. They're published from the Ministry of Agriculture in late 1937. The Ministry of Agriculture is obviously a centralised body in Madrid, but it was actually run by the Communist Party. Now, the Communist Party was also quite strong in the rural areas of Catalonia because they had a lot of support amongst the peasant proprietor and the smallholder. So why would they put up a negative figure if it wasn't actually quite true? The next one is another example. That's an example of one collective, again, an increase in production just in one collective during that period. Quickly talk about the abolition of money and labour time vouchers again. Sorry to go back to that, but I mean, some villages in Aragon and Andalusia, money was abolished and all transactions were made by barter or ration tickets, and some used labour checks. I mean, others actually went the whole way and abolished money and established a system whereby peasants were supplied with goods from the village store without any kind of payment. It was free access from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs. I mean, for anarchists, money and power were described as diabolical magic potions which turned man into a wolf, into a rabid enemy instead of into a brother. Which is similar to Marx when he said, money is the common whore, the common procurer of peoples and nations. This is an example of free access in the village of Magdalena do Pulpis. Everyone works and everyone has the right to what he needs free of charge. He simply goes to the store where provisions and all of the necessities are supplied. Everything is distributed freely with only a notation of what he took. For the first time in their lives, people could help themselves to whatever they needed. And that's exactly what they did. Free access was not abused by greed or gluttony. This is in Muniesa. The bakery was open. Anybody can come for whatever bread he wants. The question was, are there not abuses of this? No, answers the man who gives out the bread. Everyone takes as much as they actually need. Wine is also distributed freely, not rationed. Doesn't anyone get drunk? Until now, there's not been a single case of drunkenness. Now, however, I have to stress, distribution of goods on a communist basis was not the norm. Only goods in abundant supply could be taken freely. Everything else had to be bought from wages paid by the collective to its members. So, in conclusion, the anarchist collectives in the agricultural area, I mean, came closer to realising the idea of a free stateless society on a vast scale than any other revolution in history. And for a short space of time, the Spanish working class, under the influence of anarchist communist ideals, was able to achieve the most far-reaching revolution of the 20th century. I'll end with a quote from George Woodcock. He said, in their running of the factories, in their effective collectivisation of agriculture, it has often been suggested by libertarian apologists, the Spanish anarchists demonstrated triumphantly that workers can effectively control their own industries, and that Kropotkin's ideal of libertarian communism is indeed practicable in the modern world.
Thank you. Yes.
Carry on standing.